You're with us for the morning show as we learn what Antarctica's so-called doomsday glacier means for the future of our Earth. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. A team of British and American scientists, they're investigating the Thwaites Glacier. It's key for predicting how sea level rise will affect our cities and how to prepare for melting ice sliding toward the ocean. What questions do you have about how a rise in sea levels might affect Wisconsin? How should the U.S. deal with rising sea levels due to climate change? Join in at 800-642-1234. Andrea Dutton is a professor in the Department of Geosciences at UW-Madison, and her expertise is in how climate change is affecting sea levels. Andrea, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me here.
What can you tell us with the situation at the Thwaites Glacier? What are scientists seeing?
Yes. So as you mentioned, there are teams of scientists from the US and the UK who are working together to focus specifically on the Thwaites Glacier, which is one part of the West Antarctic ice sheet. And when you read about Antarctica in the news, you often hear about West Antarctica. And that's because that portion of the ice sheet is more unstable. So East Antarctica has much more ice in it. If East Antarctica melted, it would raise sea level by about 60 meters. There's only about 5 meters worth of sea level rise in West Antarctica, but it's very unstable, which is why we're worried about it. So they have targeted the Thwaites Glacier because they think it's the most vulnerable sector to try to understand about the dynamics of these outlet glaciers that feed into the ocean, and understand where are the tipping points of when it's going to start to retreat quickly. And the reason this part of the ice sheet is so unstable is that the base of the ice sheet is actually grounded below sea level. So the ice sheet is very fat and it weighs down on the surface of the Earth. You can think of it like if you go sit down on your sofa, your body depresses down on the, and that's the same thing that the ice sheet is doing to the Earth. So as the ocean waters warm around the edge of Antarctica, they're basically bathing the underbelly of the ice sheet underneath the ice shelves. And that causes retreat of the glaciers down this slope into this depression that the ice sheet has created. And once it starts that backwards kind of downhill retreat, you can't really stop it until it gets all the way back to be pinned on something else. And that's why we are concerned about the Thwaites Glacier. And some journalists have termed it kind of this doomsday glacier, because if this really vulnerable sector goes, it's kind of like the cork that will unpin the West Antarctic ice sheet, if you will.
Yeah, what would be the likely effects on sea level rise?
So today, the average rate of sea level rise is only about 3 millimeters a year, which sounds really small. It's hard to get people to understand why that's so important, that because it's already flooding our coastlines and causing a lot of problems in coastal communities. But if we reach this tipping point for the West Antarctic ice sheet and we start this rapid dynamic retreat as these marine-based sectors start to collapse, then we would be measuring sea level rise in centimeters per year rather than millimeters per year. So we're talking at least a tenfold increase. And somewhat counterintuitively, the U.S. should probably be more concerned about ice melt coming from Antarctica rather than Greenland, even though it's farther away. And the reason for this is because as the ice melts and water is distributed around the globe, it doesn't rise evenly. So it's not like turning on a faucet and filling up a bathtub. You actually get different amounts of sea level rise in different parts of the globe. And because of the effects on the gravity field as this ice sheet melts, we will see more sea level rise along the U.S. East Coast, for example, than in portions of the Southern Hemisphere that are closer to Antarctica. Because there's so much mass in the ice sheet in Antarctica, it actually attracts water in the ocean. So you can imagine the sea surface actually slopes up towards the ice sheet. It's pulled towards the ice sheet because of all that gravitational attraction. So as you melt part of the ice sheet, that slope decreases. So in the vicinity of Antarctica, sea level actually goes down, but far away from the ice sheet, which is where we are, sea level rise will go up even higher.
You mentioned the East Coast there, and I'm also thinking of New Orleans and the area around the Gulf Coast that loses, you know, football field size of piece of land every day.
Yes. So in Louisiana, they're also fighting what we call subsidence, which is the land sinking at the same time that sea level is rising. So their rates of sea level rise are very high, and that becomes very difficult to plan. So even the new infrastructure that's been built by the Army Corps of Engineers, they put in $14 billion building these new levees post Hurricane Katrina to try to prevent something like that happening again. But because the land is sinking there, those levees are really only going to be good for another few years because of the rates of sea level rise. They didn't adequately plan for these rates of sea level rise. So even having invested all of this money, you know, it's still going to be overtaken by sea level rise in the very near future, right? Which really speaks to this idea that some people have this impression that we can just engineer our way out of this problem of sea level rise. And that's an example from just one particular city or area in the U.S. We need to think about the entire coastline. We're not going to be able to just defend that coastline in place where it is now because of all the sea level rise to have in the future.
We're talking with Andrea Dutton, who is a geochemist and paleoclimatologist at UW-Madison, an expert on how climate change is affecting sea levels. We're talking about glaciers and the Thwaites Glacier in particular in Antarctica and the thinning of it. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Andrea, I want to get to your research. You received a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant last year to study how sea levels have fluctuated during our history. How are you determining this? Because I know you call yourself like a CSI for planet care.
Right. Yes. So what I do is I go around the world to tropical islands where corals grow, because we use the fossil corals to track the position of sea level through time, because corals grow near the sea surface because they need the sunlight. So we use that to our advantage to figure out where sea level was in the past. And in particular, a lot of my work focuses in on past warm periods in Earth's history, so that we can try to understand when we raise temperatures higher than they are today, or to the levels that we have today, how do the ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland respond to that warming? How much do they melt, and how quickly does that happen? And the reason we need to use the geologic period for that is because we've never been around to witness this process before at temperatures higher than present. So we haven't been around to instrument it and figure out all the physics of how this dynamic ice sheet retreat happens. So that is actually the largest uncertainty in the models that we use of the ice sheets when we're making projections of sea level rise in the future, is that we don't have a full understanding of the physics of this dynamic ice sheet retreat. But looking in the geologic record, we can provide some constraints for that to try to understand not just how much of that ice sheet will melt, but how quickly that process will take.
Well, take us back, 125,000 years ago. when was this last time the sea levels were as high as what, you know, the projections could be if the glacier melts?
Right. So one of the time periods I focus on is that time period, 125,000 years ago. So it's a warm period that was before the last ice age, right? So Wisconsin was covered by an ice sheet during the last ice age. And before that, there was a warm period where the global average temperature was about what we're already at today, but sea level was some 20 to 30 feet higher. That's 6 to 9 meters higher on average around the globe. And when we look at periods like that, where temperatures were either similar to today or 1 to 2 degrees higher for the global average, we see a similar pattern that sea levels were at least that kind of 20 feet or higher with that amount of warming. And when we first figured this out, it was a little bit of a surprise because people used to think these ice sheets are so big that they wouldn't be sensitive to that amount of warming. But it turns out that they are. So what that tells us is that the temperature that we're at today, we've raised that temperature so quickly because of our greenhouse gas emissions, that those ice sheets are still equilibrating with this new climate. It's kind of like taking two ice cubes and throwing them into a hot room and sitting back and watching them melt, which is what we're doing now. So we're watching Antarctica and Greenland equilibrate with this new temperature, this new hot room that we've thrown them into.
When you give these analogies, it seems that this work is pretty straightforward for the scientists as they watch these glaciers melt. But the conditions that these scientists are working on in the Thwaites Glacier, they're really not predictable and pretty difficult conditions being out there. Can you explain how it is as a scientist trying to do this work on glaciers?
Right. Antarctic fieldwork is not straightforward. We've gotten a lot better at it, obviously. We have field stations down there now and send planes down every year with scientists and gear. But the Thwaites Glacier is pretty remote even by Antarctic standards. So it's nowhere close to one of these field stations that any of the countries have down there. And the weather, it can be unpredictable and it can change things. So you might plan a whole field season, and sometimes you'll only get out for a few days or for a week, even if you were planning on being there for a couple of months. So the logistics behind getting all the gear and the people and obviously doing it safely, too, is enormous. But that's why doing this type of work is so important. And that is why the National Science Foundation and the UK kind of came together to this initiative to bring researchers to let's pool our resources and really hit this glacier to try to understand what's happening here.
We're talking with UW-Madison paleoclimatologist Andrea Dutton, and she's our guide to the melting glaciers, what this means for sea level rise in our cities. What do you want to know about the conditions in Antarctica and the Thwaites Glacier? What do you want to know about how a warming environment and warming water affects the glacier? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Andrea Dutton on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with UW-Madison geosciences professor Andrea Dutton about sea level rise. She describes her work like a detective putting the puzzle pieces together of our climate history. And there are new warnings from scientists about the speed in which the Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica is getting thinner and smaller. Andrea, when you look home here in Wisconsin, we're hundreds of miles away from an ocean. What effects could residents in the Midwest see from a drastic increase in sea level?
Right. So sometimes when you're this far inland, you might think you're immune to the issues of sea level rise, and you think, oh, phew, at least that's one thing we don't need to worry about, right? But unfortunately, if the coastal economy tanks, so will the national economy as well. And there's definitely a coastal housing bubble. It's not really a question of when it's going, if it's going to burst, it's more a question of when that's going to happen. And that coastal housing market itself is really kind of artificially buoyed because a lot of people have second homes there, right? And it's a lot of wealthy people can buy up extra property on the coastline. But eventually, as sea level rises, that will happen. And there are analyses that already show that housing values have dropped by billions of dollars over the last decade due to flooding-related issues in these coastal communities. But in addition to that, it's not just the housing market. It's all the goods and services that we get through the ports and the airports in our coastal cities. And think of all of the airports that are built on landfill up and down the East Coast. Even 1 foot of sea level rise would have the dire consequences for most of them. And in addition to that, you're going to get migration of people out of these coastal communities as their properties are getting flooded more frequently. And that's going to happen before they become completely inundated, because what's going to happen is they're just going to get flooded more frequently during normal high tide events during the year. And it's a question of how much can you tolerate? Maybe you can tolerate once or twice a year, but maybe not 10 days or 20 days a year of having your property flooded like that. And so while, you know, we see a lot of population growth now in coastal areas, that trend is going to change over time and people will be needing to move inland away from that area.
Let's bring in a call now. Joe is joining us from Star Lake this morning. Hi, Joe.
Yes, hello. Yes, it's an issue I've thought a lot about over the years. And I'm looking at the pandemic, how this international response is for vaccines is happening everywhere because it's so immediate. And the only answer I see for the problem we have right now is to sequester the carbon out of the atmosphere on a massive scale. And I don't know what your thoughts on that. And then if that were to happen, how quickly would that change temperatures and reverse this, if at all possible?
Jill, thank you. Andrea?
Right. So that's a good question. So there's more than one way to do it. Sequestering carbon, or literally pulling that carbon out of the atmosphere into the ground, is one way. And that's something we will probably need to tap into if we're going to meet these goals like that you hear about in the news, 2 degrees Celsius. But we can also change our energy sources. And in fact, it's cheaper for us right now to close these coal-fired power plants and switch over to renewable energy. And so we can do both of those things together. So that change can happen very fast, but the change in the temperature and the climate will be a little bit slower. So in a way, it's not kind of this immediate gratification that you get with COVID-19. You know, once we start doing something, wearing masks or staying at home, we can see the effects in a couple of weeks. And it's going to take longer than that, which is going to be hard in terms of motivating people to do it because they won't see those effects maybe right away. But the important thing is it will change the pathway that we are set upon. So it really changes our commitment for where we're headed in the long term. And so the important thing to remember is that the actions we take today can make a very big difference. And you can think about it in the same terms of the global pandemic. Our actions can change the outcome, right? The future is not just a place we get to go to. It's one that we can create together. And so we can take control of that narrative if we choose to.
Joe, thank you. Let's bring in Kate now, who's joining us from Milwaukee. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. It sounds like, I'm afraid it sounds almost inevitable that it's going to all melt. Is there land underneath there? How much land is there underneath there? And is the competition of countries, I understand that there's quite a few countries that are trying to claim area or say it belongs more to them than to others. And what about people that are trying to remove resources or like oil or any other?
Kate, you bring up many questions here on competing assets. And Andrea, what do you think?
Right. So thanks for your question, Kate. In Antarctica itself, we're fortunate that there's something called the Antarctic Treaty, which laid out a lot of these issues decades ago. And so it's not like it's just going to be a complete free-for-all because there is a treaty that's in place. But as the ice melts, and we are committed to some of that ice melting just on the basis of how much we've already warmed the atmosphere, but we are not yet at the point where all of that ice is going to melt. So again, we can take control of this narrative, and our actions can change what that endpoint is. But as that ice retreats in the areas that I was talking about earlier, where the ice sheet is based below sea level, as it retreats, you're going to be creating areas of open ocean because the land is still depressed, and it will take some time for that land to rise up, right? You know, thousands of years for that process to occur. So it's not like you'll be exposing land in those marine-based sectors right away. It's actually going to be open ocean, or actually it could be covered by ice shelves as the water on the surface freezes over that new open area.
What would that land look like when it rises to the surface?
Well, we actually know something about the Antarctic continent from some of the geophysical satellites and airborne things that we have. And so we know what the bedrock is like in different areas and what ages the sediments are. So some of it will be similar to what's exposed in other places, and some will be different. But it's been under an ice sheet for a long time, so there will be sediment related to the ice grinding up that the ground underneath it as well, underneath.
Let's bring in Mark in Kimberly. Hi, Mark.
Oh, I'd like you to comment on how the aircraft charts or navigation charts have changed, what pilots see from the air. and talk some about other tipping points, because there are, you know, like 10 of them. And for instance, the Amazon and the boreal forests, they can be net CO2 producers. We think of trees as absorbing carbon, but they're turning points. You lose 25% of the Amazon, and it's a tipping point, and you lose the rest because the trees themselves produce the rain, and you get the drying, and when you chop off the forest into small lots, and so you lose that help of trees in the boreal forest around the Arctic.
And yeah, Mark, we're short on time, but I want Andrea to be able to respond there to the tipping point.
Right. So this term tipping points, you often hear where we pass some point of no return, if you will. It really sets off a process that you can't easily reverse. And that gets used in the context of the ice sheets that we were talking about before. Once they start to retreat on this downhill slope, that's considered a tipping point. And there's debate about whether or not we've already crossed that tipping point or how close we are to it. The problem with that whole narrative of tipping points is that you don't really know where they are until you're past them. And you can look back and say, oh, there it was, right? That was the point when sea level started rising by centimeters at a time. And
like, so that 2020 hindsight.
Yeah, right, exactly, right? So instead of focusing on, you know, exactly where is that tipping point, I think the thing to focus on is the more action we can take, climate action, to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions now, the better that outcome will be. And we might pass some of these tipping points in the process, but the more we can do and the faster we can do it, the less likely we are to hit those tipping points.
Andrea, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Andrea Dutton is a professor in the Department of Geosciences at UW-Madison, an expert on how climate change is affecting sea levels. Coming up, it is On Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.